And now, 88.9 and 96.5 FM WDCR brings you The Cradle and the Convert. Join your hosts, Dave Slade and Mark Bartholomew, for a conversation about local issues with a Catholic perspective.
Good morning and welcome to The Cradle and the Convert for March 22nd, 2018 from the Annunciation Studios at St. Mary's Hospital. I'm Dave Slade, The Cradle.
And I am Dan Walker, also a Cradle.
Also The Cradle. We have no convert today, do we?
Not today. He always disappears on us.
Well, he takes off during the winter. We're talking about our other co-host, Mark Bartholomew, who should be back in 2 weeks, I guess. Something like that.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
I come in here to say hi to him because I haven't seen him, seems like, in months. And every time I show up, he's not here.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
He's got a pretty good life. Well, you know, speaking of good lives, I was off the last couple of weeks on a quick jaunt down to Florida and worked on my tan and played a little golf and got some good R&R in. And it was a very nice trip. Spent a little time in Daytona and then over near Tampa. It was just a great, relaxing trip. So
everybody needs to get away every once in a while.
Yep. You know, even Jesus told the disciples, we have to get away. We have to go and relax and get away and take a break. And it refreshes the soul. There's no doubt about it. So, boy, Dan, I'll tell you what, the news has been crazy in the past week, hadn't it? This Austin, Texas bomber.
Crazy world out there these days.
I think they've found 6 bombs now. Two people are dead and several people injured. Finding bombs this guy has triggered with trip wires and mercury switches. Probably the first couple may have been remote controlled. What drives a person to want to hurt, maim, and kill innocent people for, you know, no reason? It's just
obviously
bizarre.
Troubled individual. If you think of the trip wires and someone mentioned, you know, it could have just been a mom strolling a baby coming across that.
Yeah.
I mean, with no, it's mind-boggling the evil.
Yeah.
That is out there in this world, and the troubled souls that really need to find faith in God.
Well, I assume once they find this guy, they'll come up with a manifesto, and we'll find out what he's been so upset about.
Well, you know, last Sunday, Father Nick, I went to St. Mary's, Father Nick had an outstanding homily, and it kind of goes along with, obviously, this person's unhappy, and he talked about a lot of people looking for happiness versus purpose. And a lot of people are unhappy in this world these days because they're going around the world every day, I'm not happy, I'm not happy, I'm not happy. And they're trying to find the right job to make them happy, do this, just find happiness. And after they accomplish what they think will make them happy, they find out that they're not happy. And so what his homily is all about is, it's not really, don't be in search of happiness, be in search of purpose.
Yeah.
And really through purpose, you will find happiness. And so I think maybe this troubled soul here, you know, he's obviously discontent in his heart. He's unhappy. He has pain, and he's trying to inflict pain on others.
Yeah.
Versus a man with no purpose. Fortunately, he's no longer with us, and that threat hopefully is gone at this point in time. So Austin and Texas community can move about their daily lives.
Yeah. You know, I had a friend that used to talk about happiness, the difference between happiness and joy. Happiness is a temporary good feeling, and joy is a deep-seated, lifelong gratitude and faith. And the happiness and joy thing, you kind of have to think about it.
Well, and also happiness could be a selfish selfish trait.
All about
versus,
you.
Yeah, versus happiness from seeing joy in others, which gives you joy or happiness. So it's the perspective of which you get it.
Yeah. Hey, how's your NCAA bracket?
I'm actually on my the CBS. I have the potential to be the top 90 in the country.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I went out in the first game of the play-in.
Well, I had Virginia win it all. Of course, they lost in the second round. But, yeah, if I went out, I would be my best score. Actually, not that's if the best I can do is 90. Mm-hmm. But right now I'm 68,000.
Wow. Well,
that's still pretty good.
Darn right. I didn't make it through the first 55 million, so. We're going to have a guest on the show this morning. Sister Marguerite Cook from the Order of St. Francis is going to join us. She's going to talk about her work here at St. Mary's Hospital as a therapist, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her background and her discerning her vocation in becoming a sister. We're going to have a gospel preview for Palm Sunday coming up, and we're also going to do some community calendar stuff. So stay with us. It's Dave and Dan here on The Cradle and the Convert for March 22nd, 2018, and we'll be back after this message.
For 2,000 years, we've helped the poor and comforted the sick. We've educated generations of children, developed the scientific method and college system. We support marriage and human life. Guided by the Holy Spirit, we compiled the Bible. We are the Catholic Church, with over 1 billion in our family, sharing in the fullness of Christian faith in the church started by Jesus. If you've been away, visit CatholicsComeHome.org today. Welcome home.
All right, welcome back to The Cradle and the Convert. I'm Dave Slade, The Cradle.
And I am Dan Walker, The Cradle.
Yeah, we're both cradles today, aren't we, Dan?
You bet.
We have a guest in the studio this morning with us. And our guest is Sister Marguerite Cook of the Order of St. Francis. Sister Marguerite is one of the sisters here at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. Sister grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and she's going to tell us a little bit what it was like growing up in the bosom of the government. And she was also in the Navy in the late 60s and into the 70s. She had a military career. She discerned her calling as a sister and eventually joined the Hospital Sisters of St. Francis. We're going to ask Sister some questions about her life, and maybe she will explain to me, because I was raised in the Catholic school by Ursulines, and they were nuns. And I would like to know what the difference is between a nun and a sister. So,
and same thing, because I was a Dominican nuns.
So, Sister Marguerite, welcome to The Cradle and the Convert. Thank you for being here with us this morning. I know you are such a busy person here at the hospital, but you've been able to cut out a little time to spend with us and our listeners on WDCR.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'm honored to be here and very happy that you would have me here to talk about some of the things that happened to us as we discern becoming a Hospital Sister of St. Francis. Also, growing up in Washington, D.C. was really a privilege, and that shaped my life and will always be a significant part of my history, too. My father worked 44 years at the Pentagon, so I was not ignorant of the government. And in fact, when I graduated from high school, I wasn't ready for college. I said, I want to go in the Navy, and that's what I did. I didn't have a career, just to correct that. I only had 3 years of service, but that made me fall in love with the hospital. I became part of the Corps Wave, and I worked at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and that was still one of the best 3 years of my whole life.
That's a huge place, isn't it, the Bethesda Naval Hospital?
It really is, and I worked with a lot of military and non-military personnel, and as I said, it really shaped me into the woman that I have become, and it was a very special time in my life. Most kids go to college at that age, and that was my college.
So, Sister, your father worked at the Pentagon. Was he a military man or a civilian?
No, he was a civilian. He worked for the National Guard, and he was a budget officer. And he started back when he was a kid. He couldn't go in the war because he had blood pressure and also something with his lungs, so they wouldn't take him. So he started with the War Department during World War II.
So he still found a way to serve, didn't he?
He found a way to serve. He's always been a civil servant, he called himself. And I think I get that service from him. He was a farm boy, grew up in Indiana, but he had that service embedded in him. And our family, and in fact many, many families, people don't realize everywhere you go in that metropolitan area, you are surrounded by people who are giving service to the government. I don't think of the government as the president or his staff. I think of the government as all these people that I grew up with who are working, spending their lives for service for the country.
Now, the metropolitan area in D.C., you know, we see on TV the big buildings and the Capitol and all of that. Where do the people live that work in Washington, D.C.?
That's a good question, Dave, because many of the, there's a beltway that goes around from Maryland to D.C., all the way around D.C., and we lived actually in Alexandria, Virginia, growing up, which was just a stone's throw from the Potomac River. But there are a lot of people that live on the periphery, like we did, Alexandria, Arlington, even further out, because people get tired of that traffic, so they've moved further, and now they say the suburbs go down further south 20, 30 miles. That might even be further now. And then up in Maryland, all the way up to near Bethesda, Prince George's County, and all around the edge of D.C. is surrounded by Maryland. And there's a lot of suburbs in there, Potomac. There's also quite a bit of people living in D.C. I lived over near the Capitol when I was working in D.C., not for the government, but I resided in condominiums. They've built them along the southwest corridor. So there's southeast and southwest with a lot of residences. The northwest is mainly where the White House and all those buildings that you are talking about are.
Well, Washington, D.C., sisters, to me seems to be a very secular town. Is it also a faith-filled town? Are there people of faith? You think of the government, you don't really want to put the faith and government together because of the Constitution, the separation clause, which is really not even there, the separation of church and state. But are there people of faith in Washington, D.C. that help direct this country?
I believe so. I think in Washington, D.C., you will find many, many, many churches. And just as in any neighborhood, you will see churches that are filled or at least half filled. We have the National Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, and that's over in the southeast where I said there are, that's where Catholic University is, that's where the Franciscan Monastery is. There are certainly a lot of people in that area that are attending church there. We also have the National Cathedral, which was built during the time I was growing up. And that is generally visited by all kinds of people, natives and visitors to Washington. So I would say yes. And the surrounding areas, the neighborhoods where people, a lot of people grew up like me, there are many, many churches. I can't even tell you how many churches are in my city. There were maybe 10 when I grew up. And by the way, I had the Sisters of St. Joseph from Chestnut Hill, Pennsylvania. So I was very privileged.
Good. Okay, so you've entered the Navy, and this was Vietnam era, right?
This was the Vietnam era. I entered in 68, and I left in 71. And I would say the biggest reason, we all were influenced by John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And those words resonated with me, I think, pretty much most of my life. And I was very, very stunned by all the kids going out of high school and going either to Vietnam or going to the service. The only one in my family at that time was my brother-in-law, and he went to Vietnam. And I knew there was no way I was going to Vietnam, but I knew that I could do my part.
And you wanted to be a missionary, didn't you, with a medical background?
I wanted to go to the hospital. That's what I wanted. I really wanted to be involved in hospital work, and I got it. And back then, 50, 60 people were going through the hospital core school on a regular basis. And that's like every 2 weeks they were rolling them through the hospital medical corps.
The naval corpsmen.
The naval corpsmen.
They go with the Marines, don't they?
Right. Well, they go with the Marines, but we had 60 people in our class, and 5 were women, and the rest were all men. And that was at Great Lakes in Chicago, or near Chicago.
Right up the road.
Right up the road. My first experience with a real winter.
Yeah, right off of Lake Michigan, I have no doubt about it. So you entered the Navy, and you have decided that you want to pursue a medical career. Now, you're currently an occupational therapist. What education, is that a four-year program? Is that something like a little higher than an RN, or are they completely different? How does that work, sister?
Well, first of all, I don't know that we can equate ourselves with RNs, and I would never take that job on. I am an occupational therapist, which is a person trained in the medical field to restore function. That is our motto, just like everybody has a motto, our OT motto is function, function, function. So for instance, if I have an injury to my wrist and my thumb, that is going to inhibit my function, both in opening jars because I need two hands, or turning on water faucets, or the like, buttoning my shirt. And certainly people with strokes have an inability to restore that function. The function that enables them to do their daily tasks, and we call that activities of daily living. That is what an occupational therapist does. Now here at St. Mary's, I'm working in the mental health field, and I'm working with people and their emotions and helping them understand what can make them better, how they can live better, how they can restore their emotional functioning.
Well, how do you tie that in with a physical skill or a physical development of speaking? You know, like when my dad had his stroke, I remember him, he went to the stroke unit over at Memorial in Springfield, and they had him working with screws and nuts, you know, trying to get the fine muscles back in the fingers. When you're dealing with occupational therapy and psychological type issues, what does that entail, sister?
Well, basically, what we love to do is coping skills. And coping skills requires a gamut of things. First of all, it requires a person to look at their emotions and try and help them regulate their emotions. When people have psychological problems, mental health illness, they tend to deregulate or not take care of their emotions. So we have to teach them stress management. We have to teach them anger management. We have to teach them how to identify irrational thoughts versus rational thoughts, and how to deal with the emotions that result from all of this. You know, when you get angry, you have a physical component and an emotional component. And you have to go get rid of that energy when you get angry and then come back and deal with the problem. And so we like to teach these folks how to do it step by step so that they can still maintain their equilibrium, if you want to use that word, and not lose control all the time. It's easy to lose control when you have a problem. Even people who have stroke or traumatic brain injury lose control over their emotions. They get frustrated very easily. So we have to teach them frustration tolerance. We teach them how to feel good about themselves, self-esteem. A lot of people with mental illness do not feel good about themselves. And we teach them that this is something you're lacking and it's not your fault. And we want to give it back to you, but you have to give it to yourself. We have to teach you to build up your self-esteem. So there are many, many things we can do.
So stress and anger and frustration have an accumulative effect.
Okay.
And if they don't find a way to get rid of that in a healthy fashion, then it can be very detrimental.
It can build up, and it can cause a lot of emotional stress.
Okay, well.
And physical problems, too. People develop headaches and stomach aches and back aches and all kinds of
those things can manifest in physical form. Then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So those are the things that you're doing currently here at St. Mary's?
Actually, my job here at St. Mary's is to do activities with them, keeping all of this in mind that I am an occupational therapist. I do activities with them, but I also do coping skills.
How did you make the move from the military career and then, because you're basically a layperson at that point in time, and then you determined the calling to become a sister. Can you kind of tell me that transformation or that transition in your life you found that calling?
Yes. Dan, that was a period of 12 years. And a lot of that time I worked in Washington, D.C. doing bookkeeping. I went from hospital field to bookkeeping, bored myself to tears doing accounting and all that kind of work. But it was a good background and a good experience for me. I had a good job. I lived with another woman who herself was discerning married life. And We lived very happily. Both of us lived very near our parents. And I think at that time I was transitioning from childhood to adulthood to taking care of myself to trying to decide what I really wanted to do for the rest of my life. And there was always that background voice that said, you really want to be a sister. You really want to be a missionary. You really want to be a hospital person. So that kept nagging at me. And at the same time, I was very involved with my church and very involved in discernment for myself. So it wasn't like I closed one door and opened another. I went through a 12-year period of trying things out. And I dated. I was involved socially in many instances, but there was always that little background nudging that you want to be a sister.
You have a little bit of parallels with Father John at St. Patrick's. Yeah, kind of similar. His military career and whatnot, too, and his travels to becoming a priest. That's pretty awesome.
So you professed your vows in 1987, and a friend of ours and a friend of the show's here, I think, had a part in that, and that was Sister Chaminade Kelly.
Sister Chaminade Kelly is a wonderful St. Mary's she's retired from St. Mary's, but she was a wonderful figure in my life because in 1982 I came to visit the convent and Sister Chaminade was my vocation director. And so she helped me discern that not only do I want to be a sister, but this is the place where I really want to be. And if it weren't for her, I may not have entered this particular community because she was the drawing card, and that's what a vocation person does. It draws people into, make you interested in your congregation. And that's what she did. And then when I came in 1983 and entered the convent, she was there as my director, as the we call them postulant mistresses. She was the one that initiated me into convent living. And then she became my novice mistress. So I was a beginner, and she was there directing me during that time. So she's always been she's been like a cheerleader for me. She's always been in the background, moving me on, pushing me forward, saying, you can do it. This is character building. You can do this. And so I have her to thank for a lot of my formation, of course.
You know, she has such a quiet, holy demeanor about herself. She got me involved in the taking communion to the nursing homes and that type of thing when she was at St. James and Patrick, and has meant a lot to forming me and getting me involved in my faith much more deeply too. So it's amazing sometimes when you think how someone has reached out and how many people they may have touched in bringing them closer to God. Of course, that's what God put them here for, you know, to help us get in touch with ourselves and in touch with Him.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly, Dave. In fact, when I think of religious in my life that have really stood up, she is certainly the forerunner, but she's also, as you said, a quiet demeanor. And when she's engaged with you, you're the one. And that's what she brings to everybody, including the sisters she lives with. You are front and center in her life. And when you get that from her, you know you're important. So she was actually very instrumental in my interest in behavioral health.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. And a great tribute to her. We miss her over here. I miss seeing her at Mass and around the parish. Let me remind everybody that we're on the Prayed on Convert this morning with Sister Marguerite Cook, OSF, from the Order of St. Francis. She is employed here at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital as an occupational therapist, and she is a sister. Now, we were going to discuss a little bit about the difference between a sister and a nun. And in this day and age, there's two kind of nuns. There's the holy nuns, and then there's the N-O-N-E nuns, and those are the people we really have to work on getting back into church because they have no faith. But we're talking about the N-U-N nuns and the sisters. So can you tell me, sister, what is the what's the difference? I just thought it was the same. Sisters were nuns.
You know, that's funny because one of the patients asked me the other day, the adolescent patients, are you a nun? And I said, well, no, I'm not really a nun, but I am a sister. And then I went on to explain, and I'll explain it the way I did to this adolescent patient. Nuns are considered more contemplative. They're the monastic sisters who live by maybe the rule of Saint Benedict, or the poor clares like Mother Angelica's. Mm-hmm. They wear a habit, of course, but they're also enclosed. They're in a monastery where they stay. They don't go out. We have some of these nuns in Springfield that are living with the Dominicans, and they are Dominican nuns from New York, and they are monastic. And we do differentiate ourselves as sisters because we are more outgoing. We are apostolic, which means we go out and do works. So we don't stay at home and pray. That doesn't mean we don't pray. We do pray, but our focus in life is not staying in, but going out to meet the people.
Are the ones that stayed in, is that referred to as a cloister?
Yes, they are referred to as cloistered, and they're also termed as cloistered nuns. And that would be very different than our apostolic lifestyle.
And the Ursulines were cloistered? I mean, they taught, but I don't think they had much of a community life.
I think the Ursulines would tell you they're sisters.
Okay.
They're not cloistered.
Well, when I was a kid, the Ursulines were all mother. You know, they all had the title mother, and then somewhere along the line, they all changed to sister. So maybe that opens my eyes a little to what happened there.
I'm not sure. We'll have to ask an Ursuline.
Yeah, well.
That's probably the best way.
There you go. Now, sister, I know your travels have taken you to Arizona and Wisconsin. You served on a Navajo reservation. I know the bio says you like cooler weather and that you'd like to go to Alaska.
I always pictured myself in Alaska with the Native Americans up there. But here I am in Illinois, and I was in Wisconsin with a lot of Natives, and I did go to Arizona. I had a desire to see our missions, not to go to India or Africa necessarily, or even Japan where our missions took us, or Taiwan where we were for 25 years. I had a desire to see our Native American missions, and we were fortunate. From 1948 to 1993, we were out on the Navajo Reservation, and we were there by invitation from the Franciscans. And I had graduated and I was still a student interning in alcohol and drug abuse counseling. And so I went to Talbot House, which was a Catholic Charities on the Navajo Reservation, located adjacent to the Franciscan Friars, and we had a house there. And I stayed there for a year and a half and worked with the Navajos. And made me grow up a little bit, made me a little bit wiser in terms of alcohol and drug abuse and how alcohol affects families, whole families. And I love the Native Americans, and I will always carry that with me. So that's a beautiful spot inside of me that I nourish and cherish.
Absolutely. Sister, if we have listeners that are contemplating and maybe thinking about giving their life to God, what would you suggest they do? And I know we have dio.org at our website, vocations for the diocese, but what would your advice be to a young person that is considering a vocation in this day and age?
Well, this day and age is not so different than in my day and age. And I would suggest the first thing you do is find somebody who is religious, who you look at and say, wow, I want to be like her or him. Because that's the drawing card. That's the movement behind you to say, I want to be like that. I want to be able to do that. I want to be like him. I want to be able to say Mass. I want to reach out to all these people. So in order to do that, you want to go to the source. Go to someone who's living the life, who you think you can talk to, and get some direction. Now, the priests are all trained somewhat in spiritual direction, so